Hello, this is Cynthia McKinney, and today I want to take you on a voyage to the Pacific Ocean and hopefully a better understanding of the geostrategic implications of President Obama's pivot to Asia. The United States has outposts in the Pacific. From the California coast, I want you to let your mind's eye travel south toward Mexico, and then west out into the Pacific Ocean. That's where you'll find the Hawaiian Islands, taken by the U.S. against the wishes of the native Hawaiians who want their land back. Then I want you to let your mind's eye go south of the equator and west of Hawaii, where you'll find American Samoa. Now, American Samoa sends a non-voting delegate to the U.S. Congress every 2 years. In fact, the U.S. Congress has 6 non-voting delegates from American Samoa, Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands, Guam. That's the place, remember, where Congressman Hank Johnson thinks will tip over if the U.S. sends more troops there. The Northern Mariana Islands, and last but not least, Washington, D.C. Now, this should tell us something about what is thought about the residents of Washington, D.C., that they're placed in the same category as U.S. island possessions, otherwise known as colonies. Let no one say that the U.S. never had colonies. Now, these Pacific islands serve as outposts for the U.S. military to hopscotch its way across the Pacific to the Asian mainland dominated by Russia, China, and farther west and south, India. Japan forms like a northern barrier before you get to the actual Asian mainland. And then the Philippines is like that southern barrier. And so both of them, Japan and the Philippines, are strategically important to the United States deep state that is imperial in its ambitions and greedy in its lust for the resources of Asia. And then you add another layer to that of the cold warriors of just this generation who are still fighting Russia and China, view them as enemies, and want to fight them, as ludicrous as it may sound, in a real hot war. The Philippines are the gateway to that Asian mainland. And today is the anniversary of the independence of the Philippines. But, of course, you know, independence proved to be in name only because the moment they were quote-unquote freed from Spain, the U.S. swooped in to claim them. And Filipinos have been fighting ever since to rid themselves of the pernicious U.S. military presence that lasts until today. It is in this area between the Asian mainland and the Philippines where the politics gets real hot. Indonesia is a string of islands that take you all the way up through the Strait of Malacca to the Bay of Bengal and then over into the Indian Ocean. Sitting on the other side of the very, very narrow Strait of Malacca is Malaysia, that has had one airplane to disappear in plain sight and another shot down over Ukraine after its approved flight path was mysteriously switched. This adds even more intrigue to a series of events that were already intriguing. Now, I've been to Malaysia so many times, almost too many times to count. but I never understood its geostrategic significance until I started paying attention to events in the region, and then I turned and looked at a map. Of course, with its population being mostly Muslim, that certainly made it a point of interest for outsiders bent on destroying every Muslim country on the planet. But now I understand that there's so much more. And when the U.S. destabilization effort manifested itself in earnest, I really felt sorry for the people of Malaysia, because it's a country that has struggled with its diversity, and this destabilization effort seemed to manifest itself just at the point when the Malaysians were making strides to decolonize their minds from the Eurocentrism of the past, first of all, because they were colonized by the British, and to incorporate Malays as well as the Indians and the Chinese who populate the country. Those destabilization efforts have intensified since supporting the opposition didn't work and fomenting ethnic strife didn't work. Malaysia is lucky in that it still enjoys the leadership from behind the scenes of Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, who made mincemeat of George Soros and turned Malaysia into a self-made Asian tiger, an Asian tiger that's got oil. So to see on a map that Malaysia also forms the southern boundary of the contended South China Sea and sits astride the important Strait of Malacca tells me all I need to know to understand why a non-compliant and independent thinking Malaysia might just find itself targeted by a contending non-Asian superpower. Then we arrive at the East Asian mainland, dominated by the BRICS countries of Russia, China, and India. What, oh what, is the United States to do? If you keep going west from Russia, China, and India, you eventually reach Europe. Now, you know the United States can't have that. So, for a deep state driven by the twin evils of greed and empire building, winning Central Asia becomes the trifecta. I say trifecta because there are three things to win. First of all, winning Central Asia means that you maintain a boundary beyond which the Asians are not allowed access to Europe. Secondly, Central Asia is rich in mineral resources. And then thirdly, there's the golden triangle of drug cultivation, processing, and sales that fuels much of the U.S. covert operations and props up Wall Street. And so to control Central Asia, you protect that. Now, for a discussion of Central Asia, I've invited a dear friend of mine to share his views on this important region of the world. Ambassador Jamil Khan was ambassador from Pakistan to Libya when I first met him. Then he was sent to represent Pakistan in United Arab Emirates, which, as we know, supported the United States against their Arab brothers and sisters, and so bears some responsibility for the tragic events occurring in Libya up to now. Now retired, Ambassador Khan writes, lectures, and he's working on his PhD, just like I did for the last 4 years. I welcome Ambassador Jamil Khan, who is speaking to us all the way from Pakistan. Okay, Ambassador Jamil Khan, you're at a conference. So why don't you tell us about the conference, the audience, and you've just finished speaking. So what was your message to them as well?
Well, the topic for this conference was, particularly the topic given to me, was a strategic and diplomatic perspective of China-Pakistan economic corridor with a special reference to Balochistan of Pakistan.
Wow.
And, you know how this topic is, but anyways, I had to really update the audience about the whole perspective from the point of view of the regional dynamics, global dynamics, and more importantly, the Pakistan dynamics. So I started with two basic points which affects Pakistan. And in Pakistan, our province of Balochistan, that is a province which somehow has not been developed as much as we would have liked it. For a variety of reasons, it's a huge and a big province, a humongous province, and the population is very low. The income generation of people is also very low. And some of our countrymen, they have really resorted to insurgency recently, and that insurgency is being supported by people from across the border as well. So I'll come on those points. But to start with, one had to mention that even China, why did they conceive this project? Why did they get into the huge project of $46 billion China-Pakistan Economic Corridor? Right, there were two fundamental reason from the point of view of the topic was that Balochistan was very underdeveloped and underprivileged people living there. And also, the western region of China, the central and western region of China, that is Kashgar and Xinjiang, that is also developed comparatively poor in China, and there have been recent unrest. There have been problems in Kashgar and Xinjiang. And even while China made very recently a trade hub next to the Kazakhstan border, commercial hub of Silk Route, there were reservations and observations of the local population.
So now
that is one.
So, but now, who are these people that you're talking to? And who are the organizers of the conference that asked you to speak on such a topic?
Well, it's basically a forum, and that forum is represents Balochistan, and that's known as Balochistan Economic Forum. They're the one, they've been taking up the economic problems of Balochistan, and these days, this economic forum of Balochistan, headed by one of the Sardars, one of the tribal heads, his name is Sardar Shaukat Popezai. So he's the one who is president, and they have a complete board, and that's how they organized. And the basic topic was China-Pakistan economic corridor from Kashgar to Gwadar. And I had to cover this segment, which I just said, a strategic and diplomatic perspective on China-Pakistan economic corridor with a special reference to Balochistan. So, and that is where I started from the other end of the economic corridor, that is Kashgar, and I was coming over to Balochistan. And both these regions have one parallel, and that parallel is people are not satisfied with what they are getting. People are raising hue and cry on both sides.
Okay, now, they are different. Just for our audience, can you tell us where Kashgar is and where Balochistan is?
All right, the geographical orientation of Kashgar is, which is about 3,000 kilometers from Pakistan coastal area, which is Gwadar port, or even Karachi port for that matter of Pakistan. So, and these 3,000 kilometers of distance from Gwadar or Karachi to Kashgar, that already is connected with a road which is known as Karakoram Highway Road. So, one side is Balochistan, which is the coastal area of Pakistan, and the other side is Kashgar, which is across the border of Pakistan-China, and that point is known as Khonjra. That is the northern side, the northmost tip of Pakistani border, Pakistani territory. And after that, the territory of Xinjiang starts. And within Xinjiang, there is a sub-region known as Kashgar. And Kashgar is the place where there was a movement of East Turkmenistan movement who had created some insurgency problems in China, in that province where there were some law and order situation created and there were some explosions made. So China was able to control it. And yet that dissatisfaction still is going on. But basic reason, as I told you, was that this comparatively an underprivileged area means a poor area, and Baluchistan is also comparatively an underprivileged and a poor area. So these two areas would be developed with this economic corridor because people from these two regions would be the two ends of the economic corridor, this huge railways, pipelines, and the road network, plus the economic zone at the entire route area. So all these things would give employment, would give economic opportunities to the people in the area, and would raise their living standard by raising their per capita income. So both these territory, one in China and one in Pakistan, of course, would be the first beneficiary, and country as a whole, region as a matter of fact, would definitely be benefited because it's a network. It's a network of road, railway, sea routes, air routes all together. It makes the combined together, it's known as the Silk Route. So Silk Route is the game-changing plan in terms of trade. So if you would recall, the McKinsey consulting firm had recently published a study in which they said that from Middle East to New Silk Route in 2000, the total trade was $16 billion. In 2005, it rose to $59 billion. And in 2020, the projection is 500 billion dollars. So that is the drift which is taking place in terms of trade. So all these trade, once it is disembarked, unloaded at Gwadar, are unloaded from Kashgar to Gwadar, and both the countries and both routes would not only be benefited, this route would connect the Central Asian. This route would also connect the East, eastern part of the Asia also. So it is covering a huge area. Imagine the Arabian Sea, the Indian Ocean would be connected with Mediterranean Sea and the Pacific Ocean, just would open new vistas and would reduce the distance of the cargo from 12 days to only 36 hours.
Wow,
so that is what
huge.
The difference is. Yeah, that's huge. And the cost of freight is going to be really phenomenally reduced.
So now this is a portion of the New Silk Road that has been introduced by China.
That's right. It's with collaboration of Pakistan. But China, of course, has come up with a huge funding and huge initiative. And Pakistan has to provide some of the infrastructure and manpower, and plus Pakistan has to really come up with some matching fund in terms of real estate, in terms of human resource, and in terms of Pakistani companies participating with the Chinese companies in order to complete this China-Pakistan economic route.
Now, has the Pakistani political apparatus approved its participation in this project?
Well, initially there were some reservations about the political apparatus, as you said, the political parties, some of the opposition political parties from the smaller provinces. They had initially raised their observations And they were not agreeing to all the points of the federal government, but subsequently with more negotiations and more discussions with the political party, all the political parties, they assembled in the National Assembly, in the parliament, and also in all-party meeting. So they unanimously discussed, decided, and now they all are on one page.
Well, now, Pakistan sits in a very central location, not only for the New Silk Road, but these various pipeline routes that have been introduced as well that would carry natural gas and oil from places of origin to places where it's used. So could you talk a little bit about how all of this works into the kind of network that would unite this part of Asia in a way that it hasn't been united probably in a very long time, if ever?
As you would know, that China has such a quest about energy. Energy is a huge problem of China. And China's more than $17.6 trillion economy, an ever-expanding economy, and Chinese, the largest trading nation since 2013, largest manufacturing country in the world since 2010, they need energy. And currently, the energy which they get from Middle East, they are rather altogether, they're importing 60% of the oil supply. And all this oil supply, it takes them about 12 days minimum to take it to their country from Middle East, any part of the Middle East, 12 to 13 days, 15 days. And 32% of the gas, again, it is being imported through the LNG, liquefied natural gas, mostly from Qatar. It goes to China. Now, if this corridor is made, obviously, it's going to reduce that much of distance because this corridor would not only have a metal road, but also oil pipeline.
By metal road, you mean the railway?
Well, railway is also included in this corridor. Mm-hmm. So one is railways. The second is the pipelines on the side of the road. And third one is the highways and the roads. So they all are in one package.
I see.
That's how it becomes China-Pakistan economic corridor with so many economic zones in different regions of the road and different segments of this China-Pak economic corridor. And imagine 51% of oil of the Middle East, out of these 51%, 43% of oil, it passed through Strait of Hormuz. And the Strait of Hormuz is vulnerable. You know, it's just right in front of Iran, and it is also in front of Gwadar. And 82% of their entire oil import, it passes through Malacca. So Malacca is a choking point that becomes even more significant, and it is the choking point, which is just about Malacca, is connecting Indian Ocean to South China Sea and Pacific Ocean. It's 1.7 miles in width, and it allows and facilitates 15 million barrels of oil per day, and half of the world commercial shipping. It passes through this strait, and one third of the world LNG pass through it. So what does it signify? It signifies the strategic interest of various powers of the world in this area. Anyone who controls the Strait of Malacca, which is the mouth of the Indian Ocean to South China Sea, anyone who controls it would control the trade back and forth to China.
Well, now, you've also got...
That could be one of the reasons, not complete, but partially, one of the plausible reasons where India has now gone into agreement of United States, in which they have 10 years of military framework agreement, which gives a big boost to Indian military. And that means the construction of the warships, constructions of the aircraft carrier, construction and manufacturing of the fighter planes, and so on and so forth. Why they could be doing that?
Go ahead.
Why they could be doing that? It's the, as I said, state of Malacca, which is between the Indonesia, perhaps, yes, and close to the Malaysia. It passes through those regions. So once they pass through that, that very 1.7 miles or kilometers of a stretch, it becomes very, very significant for the world powers to control it. If the economy of the China is to be kept under check, so what they have done, Japan, Australia, United States, India, they are now collaborating to have their influence. And obviously, United States has its influence since decades, and they would obviously not like to their influence to be faded out. And that is where the actual strategic persuasion of various group of countries is going on in this region, where they want to have influence on the Arabian and Indian Ocean to have these small choking points under their control and under the water under their influence.
Well, now, I think I missed this 10-year military agreement between India and the United States. When did that happen?
Well, it happened only about 10 days ago. I think about a week or 10 days ago. It's very fresh, very, very fresh. And after, you know, what happened? After this 10 years agreement with the United States, India has started, you know, showing their teeth to certain countries. They have gone and raided inside Burma on the pretext of going after the rebels, those who are demanding independence from India. And they have also been threatening their neighboring countries such as Pakistan ever since they have gone into that agreement. There could be other reasons also, but after this agreement, all these things have started triggering off. So yes, it is a very significant and cardinal agreement so far as the regional balance is concerned. It's all about the strategic balance in the region, and that only facilitates the trade and economics of this entire region.
Well, now this is very interesting. This is a very interesting outcome, because I remember reading probably several years ago, maybe now, when the countries of the region proposed a peace pipeline that included India, but it also included Pakistan and it included Iran as well. And it's my understanding that at the very last minute, the Indians changed their mind and withdrew, which dampened the prospects of the peace pipeline. And then there was an alternative. Now the United States is also standing in the way of the new Silk Road as originally envisioned by the Chinese and the local countries. And they have proposed an alternative route for the new Silk Road. And but at the same time, you've got BRICS, which has China and India cooperating along with Russia. So, you know, I don't know if you've been looking at BRICS at all, but how now does the Indian military relationship with the United States, what does that do to Chinese-Indian cooperation?
It's not only India collaborating and India participating in all the BRICS and being a member. So it is also India was one of the first members of the newly established Asian Infrastructure Bank. And India also is represented at various forums in the region. So on one side, India is really trying, and it should try, to become the economic giant And remember, India has 1.2 billion population. China has 1.4 billion population. And remember, India by 2020 is going to surpass the population of China by about 1,000 million. Right. So the total population of India by 2020 would be about 1.15 billion, which would be higher than the Chinese. So with that population, they want to become, or they want to become a counterpart or counterbalance with China. So that competition, if it's a healthy competition, it's good for the world, but it is just walking on a sharp knife, sharp edge. It could be a healthy competition. It can become an unhealthy competition. If they start blocking certain choking point, if they start creating problems in certain projects like China-Pakistan economic corridor, then obviously there would be a flashpoint. And if there is any flashpoint, it's going to be this choking point, which I just said, which is Strait of Malacca. This choking point could be a flashpoint, as there are interest of Japan, interest of the United States, interest of Korea, interest of Philippines. So therefore, there are a lot of riffraff on the strategic scenario and strategic horizon. A lot of riffraff is going on, and things are really shaping up in a different way. And this is the time that the diplomats and the politicians of the world should join their heads and hearts together and make sure that there is no flashpoint while people are competing for the commerce and economics of the region. And China also is definitely growing influence vis-a-vis India and US. And that's why there's a counterbalance being created. So a lot of seesaw going on in this region. And Chinese also definitely desires to become dominant naval player in Indian Ocean. India and China each are trying to have full control over the routes connecting East Asia to Euro-Asia and Africa, dominating economic and commerce and commercial interests. So all these things are really going very, very fast in this region, and this generation is going to see lots of heat which is going to be generated. And obviously, U.S. has been very forthcoming in getting sucked in into the regional problems. And I would not be surprised even at the later stages if the U.S. gets sucked in into the regional problems of Asia. I only hope that it doesn't happen, but you never know.
Well, of course, you know, the President Obama has announced several years ago his pivot to Asia. And so, therefore, the United States might not have been sucked in, but the United States is trying to insert itself into the politics of Asia and has done that with its own efforts to block the progress of the New Silk Road, as just one example. You mentioned Africa, and I know that our time is winding down as well. You served as the ambassador in Libya, and then from Libya, you moved over to the United Arab Emirates. And looking at what's happening now in that part of Asia, what I see is the United States and Israel, of course, are engaged in what I consider to be an Arab genocide. What do you see as the future for this Arab part of Asia? And do you think the Blood Borders map is becoming a reality?
Well, the indicators are there. And in fact, recently I wrote my book and I've sent it for the publication and printing. And I have given a lot of arguments. And that those arguments definitely, it augments what you have said, that the geographical boundaries seem to be changed in the coming future in Middle East area, the Arab Asia, what you said. So that's true, and there are indicators. look, you know, what's happening in Syria. Look, what has already happened, and it's being replicated in Yemen, what has happened in Libya. So in a different way, in a different style. So my point is, if we have created a situation in Syria where about 150,000 have lost people, innocent people have lost their life almost, and three times have become the IDPs and the refugees, I don't know what are we up to, and see what has happened to Iraq, and see what is happening in Libya and what has already happened there. So what you have asked me, and this mapping of the new war and the blood borders, well, whosoever was the author of it, that Colonel Robin, I guess he gave enough logic, and now we can see the indicators that some of these things may as well happen in the near future.
The author of that map, Blood Borders map, was Ralph Peters. Finally,
yeah, Ralph Peters, thanks.
Yes, and finally, I'd just like to hear your thoughts about your own home country of Pakistan, which is in a very dangerous neighborhood and is facing a hostile world trying to maintain its sovereignty. Tell me about, as a final word, how you see the prospects for Pakistan being able to maintain its sovereignty under the conditions that are existing in its part of the world.
Yeah, no doubt we have challenges. We have challenges of security. But so far, your question about the sovereignty, Pakistan obviously is a country with about 600,000 army, a very strong army, although we are under debt of about 17 to 18 trillion rupees, right? So the debt, having that in mind, rupees means about $17 billion. So have about that in mind, I guess, yes, there are challenges. But at the same time, the kind of a professional armed forces which we have, it won't be an easy task for any country to really think about touching the sovereignty of the country. But at the same time, the efforts of the neighboring country in particular of introducing a fourth generation war in Pakistan, that is being circumvented, and that's being countered by the Pakistani people and the Pakistani organization and institutions. We are halfway through, and recently you might have heard about operation which has been directed towards the Taliban and towards the terrorists. It is a success story. It's a very good military success story. The only thing is the political follow-up of such operation can only give the dividend. Otherwise, if it's not politically followed up properly with the economic package, with the welfare package, then probably it would be a timely affair only. But your question, Pakistan is a nuclear power and in the neighborhood of another nuclear power. So it would not be in the interest of the world that the heat is generated between the two nuclear power in this part of the region. That's and right. It's not going to be beneficial for anyone in the region or around, because we can imagine the devastation if it goes to that flashpoint. I strongly hope that the flashpoint should not reach, and that's where the world community should come in, step in, and make sure that the heat is not generated to the level where the two nuclear power gets entangled with each other and are forced to apply the last option.
Well, thank you so much, Ambassador Khan, for the time that you've spent with us. And I will leave you now so that you can go back to your conference.
All right. Thank you very much for having me.
Okay.
And I hope to talk to you later at some stage. All the best.
Okay.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye. So there we have it. I hope in your mind's eye, you were able to follow us across the Pacific and peer inside of President Obama's pivot to Asia. I don't think the U.S. can out-Asia the Asians. And besides, we have too many issues to take care of at home. Why are our students laden with debt? Libya had free education all the way up to the PhD level. Why does Obamacare reward the insurance industry and we the people think that's equivalent to healthcare? Why don't we use technology to free ourselves with solar energy? My favorite is the concept of solar highways. Why are we using immigration as a union-busting labor policy to bust higher wages when people in the U.S. need jobs and people outside of the U.S. would much rather live in dignity at home with their families, neighbors, and friends? What kind of world are we creating? Yes, we. Because if we don't act positively to create the world of our vision, others will use our omission and create a world of their vision. President Dwight D. Eisenhower said, "Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired, signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. This is not a way of life at all in any true sense. Under the clouds of war, it is humanity hanging on a cross of iron." Don't we deserve better from the United States? Don't the Asians deserve better from us? This is Cynthia McKinney, and I'm signing off.